Good evening and welcome to Men Matter. My name is Kevin McGuire, hosting tonight, and my special guest is Dean Tong, author and expert forensic consultant, written several books, notably Elusive Innocence, Ashes to Ashes, and Don't Blame Me, Daddy, all regarding families going through times of difficulty regarding allegations, separation, reunification. And let me stop there. And Dean, welcome. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me this evening. It's a pleasure being here.
I know it's you're back in Florida, so it's 8 o'clock. Appreciate you taking the time tonight. There's a lot that you've done, and your body of work speaks for itself. I think a lot of listeners, certainly since your perspective is so wide-ranging, talk to the problem that a lot of listeners and a lot of folks have is they find themselves in, and if we could just use the word, the system or the divorce system, we'll call it the system for now, and they are utterly and completely unprepared for what's coming. Often attorneys are as well. If you could, talk a little bit about both the surprise factor of allegations and accusations and how it naturally puts people back on their heels, and how that is both difficult to approach as the person accused, and how the system can use that in a way to make things worse for the person who's accused.
Right. Well, first of all, Kevin, I'm going to premise the talk with this is a well-meaning, well-intentioned system. Unfortunately, these well-meaning, well-intentioned laws that were legislated in 1974 and then 20 years later, 1994, and I'm talking about the Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, known as CAPTA, also known as the Mondale Act, and the Violence Against Women Act in 1994, also known as VAWA, basically empowered Health and Human Services out of Washington, D.C., and the Department of Justice to promulgate laws that were meant to protect children and women. I'm not trying to be gender biased here, but that's exactly what has happened over the last 40 years approximately. And when an allegation of abuse is filed as a complaint, there doesn't need to be physical medical proof. It doesn't need to be broken bones or fractures or ripped clothing or blood or forensics or DNA or broken hymens or any of the sort. All there needs to be is he said, she said, they said, what a young child said. That's it. This is known as basically res geste evidence. It's hearsay that is legally admissible as an exception to our hearsay rule. So any abuse outcry comes into evidence on the record. Then it's up to either A, the attorney, to impeach the credibility of that accuser, albeit woman or child, or an expert like myself to critique the reliability, validity, trustworthiness of the outcry to see if it was made contemporaneously, spontaneously, or it was the product of taint contamination. Basically, these allegations of abuse can be made within the context of a divorce, visitation dispute, parenting time dispute, or custody battle, but they can also come to fruition via many other sources and ways and manners, such as it could be a teacher making a mandated call from school because she saw a bruise on little Sally's leg, or little Sally looked sullen and sad in class, and upon questioning by the teacher, all of a sudden my stepdaddy touched me in my private part. And I might add that the teacher is not an expert in forensic interviewing, probably has no clue as to the different types of interviews that are out there that we use, the methodologies. But as a mandated reporter, a teacher, a police officer, a social worker, a therapist, doctor, nurse, These people all have to report any reasonable suspicion of child abuse to the abuse hotline or to the police and or Child Protective Services. And that's how this well-meaning, well-intentioned system takes over. So once a perhaps meaningless, trivial allegation all of a sudden has teeth, it all of a sudden has it has fire, it has power, and the system is now in full charge, in full control, and they are absolutely going to protect the welfare of that woman who has perhaps just made a statement of fear or threatened bodily harm, again, with no proof, no evidence, or a child where there's no physical corroborating independent proof to back up his or her allegation. And I can tell you, once you get in the system, it's very difficult to get out. You are presumed guilty. You have to attempt to prove a negative, and that's very difficult. Most attorneys don't know how to do that. I have a special formula that I utilize in my cases as an expert witness and as a trial consulting expert in court. And not many lawyers know how to do this across the globe, actually. And, with all due respect to the attorneys, they just don't get this stuff in law school. This is on-the-job training. And, again, if folks go to my website, abuse-excuse.com, you can see just how busy I get. I mean, I've had almost 850,000 hits at my website. I'm just one guy. But lawyers are just never going to see as many cases as I do. And there's nothing I haven't heard or seen over my almost 30 years of being involved in this system.
As you've seen all these cases, do you think that there's a common thread of both resolution, those cases which are evaluated correctly, go through the investigation process, whatever that may be, done smoothly, done correctly, done with objectivity and an eye on protecting the child or the woman in whatever case may, and are done right, as opposed to the time frame of what many people, and I've spoken to, see as the normal but the system gone awry path, which goes anywhere from, it's over in a week when it should have been an hour, and go up to, decades. Is there a best case scenario that you found that can serve as an example of how things work correctly? How much time is involved in that? Days, weeks, months? Or am I just looking for some light at the beginning of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think you're shooting at a star that doesn't exist there, Kevin. First of all, there's no statute of limitations on how long the prosecution or child protection does have a window, usually 30 days up to 60 to complete their investigation. So that, there is a window there, but the police don't. They can keep you under investigation for months, for years. And the statute of limitation on child rape in most states is 25 years or more. In my state of Florida, for all intents and purposes, it's ad infinitum. You can be accused back from 1960, by an adult person who's in her, 50s or 60s right now. So, my average case runs anywhere from 6 months to 20 months, with an average of me being on the case for anywhere from 10 months to a year. So that's a long time. And especially looking at the criminal context, knowing that you have a 6-month right to speedy trial from the date of arrest, that if someone hires me today who's been arrested, for all intents and purposes, Dean Tong is going to be on that case in 2012, because your case is not going to be resolved until 2012. You can take that to the bank and cash it. So, the system is very... If you think they put your case in the back of a file cabinet and they forgot about you, think again. And most of my child sex cases today are the delayed disclosure, what we call delayed memory recall cases, based on the delayed discovery doctrine, where kids come forward, especially teeny boppers, 15, 16, 17, come forward and say they were sexually abused 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago. Those are the toughest cases to defend because they involve memory. You know, they involve obviously no evidence whatsoever other than hearsay. For the most part, in today's recession, the defense doesn't have the resources to hire a private investigator to go out and obtain collateral interviews of perhaps other possible suspects or certainly witnesses that can impeach the credibility of the complaining witness in the case. So it's tough.
Yeah.
And make no mistake, I'm getting more calls from attorneys today in 2011 than I did 10 years ago, and certainly than I did 20 years ago. My first book published in 92. And unfortunately, the crop of attorneys I'm seeing today are less competent than 10 years ago. It's that bad. I mean, I just got hired in a case from Arkansas, and, you know, the attorney filed a motion for a forensic interview of the child who's accused our client of molestation. And I said, counsel, with all due respect, your motion is going to be categorically denied. For one thing, you know, you're contributing to the de minimis trauma of repeated interviews of the child, and you won't find anybody to do it. I mean, when I'm on a case, I don't meet the children. I don't meet the mother. I don't meet the other professionals in the case. I'm here to critique the forensics in the case. I'm here to see if child protection dotted their I's and crossed the T's, whether the police did the same, whether the forensic interviewer and sexual abuse nurse examiner or medical doctor did the same. So, you know, that's what I do. And, you know, so he finally got it after we talked to actually today and said, you know, I think I might withdraw that motion because I think you're right. It's going to be denied, and I might even get hit with sanctions for attorney's fees. So, you know, the lawyers really need to get a clue. I wish I could put myself out there and give seminars in all 50 states. I just don't have the time to do so. But the attorneys could certainly earn the continuing legal education credits to understand what's going on here.
Now, is that, Dean, is that born out of sort of a what seems to be an increasingly overwhelming sense of not being able to fight City Hall in these allegations? They're excruciatingly expensive. They're protracted. They're emotionally involving, even for the most detached and objective attorney. And it is one where I'm sure in many cases there are, even the court would like to see it just let's handle this rather than drag it on and drag it on. And as this is going on, of course, children age and people want to make the...
Well, let me get back to this particular case, Kevin. I told the attorney, I said, counsel, let me play devil's advocate with you, and let's say that the court was going to entertain granting your motion. Granting your motion to re-interview the child by your expert would be the same as doing another genital exam, another genital rape exam on the kid, by colposcopy, by Medscope. Would you subject the child to that? Is that really in the child's best interest? No, you wouldn't. You would critique what the system did with the kid, whether they did it right or did it wrong, and what the what your expert's findings are, what the opinion is, and you know that's what I do. So, this attorney is well-meaning, well-intentioned, just like the laws, but green. You know, and it's probably why he hired me in the first place, because you know he really, you know, doesn't have a good grasp on what to do here.
So.
And, you know, for another thing, I told him that your guy needs to go through a risk assessment, psychosexual testing, One of the tests we use is called the ABEL screen. That's A-B-E-L screen.com. That's our smoking gun test. There are other tests, but that's psychophysiological because it's done off a laptop computer, or half of it is. And he said, well, why do you do that? I said, well, I do that, counsel, because it's a risk assessment. And the court is mandated to rule in the child's best interest by a preponderance of evidence, 51%. So if the court can't take the risk and is going to err on the side of caution, on the side of the child against your guy, then I'm going to put your guy through a risk assessment. So I take the he said, she said out of the equation, and now I have empirical raw test data to see whether your guy has the propensity to molest children because he's first sexually interested in children. This is called the sexual preference hypothesis. I'm published in that area as well. And, I mean, this science has been around for 50 years.
Describe that. Describe the ABEL test, then, for some of the listeners who are unfamiliar with these.
The ABEL is a 160 tests. It's 160 slides, fully clothed children, but basically it's trying to glean whether you have sexual interest in children or consenting adult females. The methodology is visual reaction time, or VRT, or viewing time. So you're on a mouse, obviously on a laptop computer, and you're going to click that mouse. You're either going to click it quickly because you're disinterested in the stimulus, the cue, the picture you're looking at, or you're interested. You're gonna stay on that picture. So obviously with the children, we want quick clicks is what we want. That's what we're looking for. It's based on a Likert scale of 1 to 7, where 1, you are most sexually averse to the stimulus or disgusted by it, and 7, you're most attracted to the stimulus. So obviously we want 1s with the children, 7s with the adult females.
That must be a pretty fine line for measurement, though. That's got to be a...
It has really good reliability and validity. It's up around 90% or so, and really good specificity, sensitivity. It's met Daubert challenges in many Daubert jurisdictions across America, and there's really no controversiality in the test. There's nothing hooked up to you like the penile plethysmograph, so you know. It's not abusive in and of itself, if you will, like the PPG. And I also do this for guys who've been accused falsely of domestic violence. Not the ABEL screen, but we run them through a battery of paper pencil psychometrically validated tests, such as the SARA, S-A-R-A, which is the spousal assault risk assessment, the domestic violence inventory, the DVI, the CTS-2, the conflict tactic scales, which, of course, the research was done by Murray Strauss out of Family Research Lab in Durham, New Hampshire on that one. Murray's one of the big anti-spanking experts out there, but also has published a lot with Steinmetz and Gellis on the fact that men are domestically abused perhaps just as much as women. So I'm a firm advocate, Kevin, of the testing. It is a tool that I use, but I have to have a lawyer who understands how to use it because I'm not going to spend a client's money, send him for testing, get a clean bill of mental health, and then the lawyer does not introduce the report into evidence on the record to help the client. So, look, if I have a lawyer who doesn't understand Daubert Frey, Houston, we have a problem. I mean, we're talking law 101 here as it concerns experts in science. And how do we tender reports into evidence on the record through an expert? How do we get into evidence on the record learned treatises, seminal peer-reviewed scientific articles on suggestibility or memory or linguistics or whatever the issue is at bar? And so I'm actually appearing in Philadelphia the day before Father's Day. I'm speaking... folks can click on over my website at abuse-excuse.com and click on the icon that says Tong on Topic, and they can see the conference that's going on in Philly the day before Father's Day. I'll be I'll be giving a seminar on how to defend these cases from an attorney-client perspective, and how to try the suggestibility case, which is a lot of these cases that come across my plate. It doesn't necessarily have to be on a divorce custody battle either, I might add. And I might add also that just because there might be a divorce and custody battle on the table doesn't make the sexual allegation or abuse allegation false. When Dr. Gardner first wrote about this about 30 years ago, Richard Gardner, he keyed in on the timing of the allegation as being a indicator or red flag that this may be a false or unfounded allegation for the court to take judicial notice, if you will, that based on the timing of the red flag allegation, it's more probably untrue than true. But I have seen legitimate molestation and abuse within the context of divorce and custody battles. So just because an allegation is surfacing in the middle of a protracted, what we call said case, sexual allegation and divorce, doesn't necessarily mean it's false or untrue.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, it's not it's not to say that all allegations are false. That's not what I was leaning at. It was how to use empirical, objective evidence that provides a step back from sort of the immediate gut reaction. As soon as you say sexual abuse or child abuse, everyone's hair should bristle and say, oh my gosh, let's watch our caution here. Let's proceed in a manner that's going to give us the least possibility of making an error. So these tests then become sort of an objective, empirical, technically reproducible item, which has assurance beyond someone's, well, I think this or my opinion that. It sounds reliable to a reasonable degree.
It is. And again, it's just one piece of the puzzle.
Right.
You still have to critique, obviously, you have to answer the $64,000 question, why would the child say you touched her private part unless it happened? If you don't have a smoking gun answer for that, you have a problem. That can get you arrested. It can put you into dependency court, juvenile court, facing a CPS attorney. It can put you on the state child abuse registry. You can be litigating in what I call in my book the three-ring circus in a New York minute. So you can't just, you know, claim your innocence. Asserting your innocence is no innocence at all. You have to fight fire with fire and come out with an aggressive response.
And I think that's where a lot of people find themselves too far down the road without having realized it, and that is sort of the innate trust the system, oh, they'll figure this out, this is pretty straightforward, there's nothing happened or nothing there, etc., only to find themselves facing a prove your innocence mentality.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, I've had two cases that, you know, I'm going to just in about a minute's time go over them real quick for you and your audience, but I mean, you wouldn't believe that these cases would ever make a courtroom. One was in 2007. I was in Dallas all week at counsel table as a trial expert with a guy who was facing 20 years because his former stepdaughter, who was 26 at the time she testified against him 4 years ago, claimed when she was 14, a dozen years earlier, that while he was molesting her, she saw aliens in biochemical suits and UFOs.
Oh, come on.
Well, this not only made it to trial, it got him arrested and charged, and he was facing 20 years.
How did that go?
He got convicted. He got convicted, oh. And he had three attorneys and Dean Tong at his defense counsel trial table. And the judge would not hear our memory expert. The judge would not entertain any testimony on repressed memories or recovered memory therapy. So that eradicated our memory expert, his report and his testimony, which hurt our defense greatly. Yet the judge did allow a therapist who corroborated the girl's story to testify. And, of course, she was well-known by the Dallas courts and the Dallas system. Now, the guy did go through the psychosexual testing repertoire that I usually require in cases, and he passed with flying colors, and that's what only got him 2 years in prison. The judge actually gave him the minimum sentence under the guidelines because he passed the psychosexual, and our doctor was allowed to testify, and his report came into evidence on the record. But he did get convicted. He's a convicted felon, and he had to, or he's still under the Megan's Law sex offender registration. Oh. The other case I had was a little four-year-old girl recently from North Carolina. I actually testified as an expert in that case. And she said, my daddy cut off my pee-pee, took it for a walk, and taped it back on.
And that
cost the father, the gentleman, my client, 2 years of normal parenting time with his kid. That outcry right there, which came from mother's mouth, of course, not the child.
Oh.
And so when I got on the stand, and I was on the stand for 7 hours on that case in North Carolina, I told the judge, I said, Your Honor, with all due respect, I'd like to precede my articulation to the court on how the girl came to say what she said by telling Your Honor, this did not happen. This did not happen, Judge. There's no blood. There's no sutures. There's no nothing. A little girl, you know, did not lose her vagina. It didn't come off her body, and it wasn't taped back on. Now, Judge, I will get into how she came to say what she said. And actually, about a month before she allegedly told her mother this scenario, the father had a situation with the girl. She had a wound on her buttocks, and the little girl saw him apply an adhesive bandage with bacitracin ointment. She saw him cut the bandage and apply tape and gauze to the infected area, and that's how she came to say what she said. So in psychology, we call this a source misattribution error, where there's another possible explanation, another source or origin for the alleged abuse. And there's a lot of studies on source misattribution error. I've got a whole boatload on my hard drive.
And I'm guessing kids that age have certainly, you know, I've heard them all, have various names for anything having to do with their body in any particular part. And that could have been her descriptor for anything where she needed to use the bathroom or identify.
Yeah, I mean, here's another one I had back in 2000 from Daytona over 10 years ago from my state of Florida. Little Amber said that her daddy put his pee-pee on her pee-pee. And, of course, that got him arrested for lewd and lascivious behavior, second-degree felony under Florida law. But what the little girl meant was that daddy urinated on top of Amber's urine in the commode she forgot to flush. She wasn't meaning genital-to-genital contact. But, of course, that's what the police figured it was. That's what child protection figured it was. Make no mistake, these are not PhDs out in the field doing these investigations. These are minimally educated, minimally trained police officers with perhaps a 40-hour course in child development and child pathology, and the same goes for child protection social workers. This is what you're getting in the field. This is who is getting called by the toll-free hotline from Anchorage or Tallahassee or wherever you are from the state capital in your state, who is disseminating the call to the protection people in your area where the complaint came from. A dispatcher who's making $8 an hour is giving the social worker the rundown of what was called to her, and then this is the person who basically takes over the investigation, under a supervisor, of course.
Right. Now, you mentioned before, and it's a, if I can brush on it, different types of forensic interviews. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean, I always think of the sit in the room, there's someone there, there's a video camera and a tape on, maybe some people behind one of those double or two-way mirrors. But when you say different types of interviews, forensic interviews, what? Tell a little more about that.
Well, back in the 80s, Kevin, the first type of interview that came out was called the cognitive interview. And that embellished into the stepwise interview, Dr. John Yule from British Columbia, Canada. Basically, he thought it was best that kids should be interviewed multiple times, piecemealed, if you will, because they come out with bits and pieces of information. Now, that is true to a certain extent. You know, because, of course, in memory cases, delayed disclosure cases, we only recall, because memory, you know, is encoded, it's stored, it's retrieved, and then it's reported. That's how memory works. In trauma, whether you're shot in Vietnam or the Gulf War or Iraq or Afghanistan, or you're sexually abused and sodomized, you're only going to remember certain traces in your memory, in your right brain, of that trauma event. You're not going to remember the entire ordeal, especially as time passes on. So Dr. Yule thought his best interview methodology was a stepwise methodology that he came out with. Well, that was trumped by what's called the one that the system is, for all intents and purposes, using now in all 50 states today, called the RATAC, R-A-T-A-C, or finding words methodology. RATAC stands for rapport, build rapport with the kid, anatomical identification, body parts, touch inquiry, good touch, bad touch, secret touch. A is the abuse scenario itself, and then C is closure. So the acronym is RATAC, R-A-T-A-C, and that is the one that most child advocacy centers use across America today. The one that Dean Tong and his colleagues, especially his colleagues, actually did the studies on and published on, and I'm talking about Dr. Phil Esplin, Dr. Michael Lamb, who's now at Cambridge University in the UK, Dr. Sternberg. It's called the NICHD. This is the best evidence, best methodology, best practice interview type. NICHD is the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development. It's a subsection of the NIH, the National Institutes for Health,
right,
Bethesda, Maryland. And this is a fully structured protocol. There is no room for leading questions, suggestive questions, reinforced behavior, dolls, puppets, drawings, cake, candy, or ice cream. There's no room for closed-ended questions. It requires open-ended questions, basically requesting from the child to tell me what happened, requesting a free recall, free account, free narrative of the child's own free volition without any prompting, any cues. I rarely see that type of interview implemented. Now, I'm told that Washington State is now implementing the NICHD. I haven't had a case from Washington State in some time, and that may be due to the fact of lack of resources from folks in that state. But almost all the interviews I see are semi-structured at best. The NICHD is a fully structured methodology.
Now, with the NICHD, it's not a pick and choose. You use it or you don't. Is that correct?
Pretty much. Yes, that's the case.
You can't take like Section A for your state and Section B. There's not, as I understand it, there's not, in using that protocol, it's not designed for significant or really any modification beyond certain parameters. You can't just pick and choose and say, we like these three things, we're going to use those and forget the big picture. It's not designed in that manner, as I understand.
That is correct.
Right. So that should be, and I've read something on this, that should be the thing that's used everywhere. But in fact, that it isn't used everywhere, is that in and of itself a reason to question the type of interview that was done in the manner of saying, well, why didn't you folks use the most up-to-date NIH-sponsored book? Is that something that has been brought to the fore in court cases, perhaps?
Well, in court cases I'm on, because, you know, all family court, dependency court cases, criminal cases require best evidence. There's case law on best evidence.
I guess I asked the question wrong. I guess what I should say is, to your knowledge, is the NICHD, that's not the overwhelming favorite nationally, it sounds like.
It's not only not the overwhelming favorite, 90% of the systems never heard of it. Never even heard of it.
It's been out there for years.
The first publication came out on it in 2000, 11 years ago. And most system professionals have never heard of it. So this is what I'm talking. The system that's getting educated and trained to carry out the well-meaning, well-intentioned, but abusive laws out there that's predicated on money. And I'll never forget what Dr. Ralph Underwager said when he was alive. He wrote the foreword to my first book, Don't Blame Me, Daddy, back in 92. If we took the profit away from the system, the solution would go a long way towards correcting itself. So, yeah, make no mistake, this is a money-making industry. But, you know, the system cherry-picks the curriculum, child development, child pathology, cognitive child developmental psychology, forensic interviews, taint hearings. They may get a smattering knowledge of taint hearings that, you know, taint hearings exist now in America. But for all intents and purposes, they don't know about these risk assessments, psychosexual testing, the NICHD methodology. They've never even heard of Dr. Cece's book, Jeopardy in the Courtroom, was published back in 95 by the American Psychological Association.
A classic.
Cece's book has now been one-upped by my colleague Phil Esplin's book, which came out in 2008, Tell Me What Happened, published by Wiley. That's a great book. It's over at Amazon.com. So
yeah,
that's part of the problem here. It's a huge part of the problem. Lack of education, lack of training on the part of these child protectors, both from CPS and the authorities that are out there so-called protecting children and families.
So at least from the people, and, you know, some experience I've had and other folks have said the same thing, it seems that unfortunately, and perhaps an oversimplification, is that with regard to a lot of the allegation investigations and the process by which people are put through those, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. It starts off as a let's be sure, and then it quickly takes the road the wrong way.
Absolutely. I think John Stossel used that same quote you just came out with on 2020. But, yeah, I mean, look, I'm not saying that these cases are witch hunts. I am saying a lot of these are fishing expeditions. And certainly while there is a fishing expedition going on down one end of the street, there's a kid being molested or abused down the other end. And certainly we don't have enough caseworkers and police to go around to be, you know, doing this. And the police feel like they shouldn't be babysitting domestic cases anyway, unless you've committed a crime.
Right.
Instead of putting more social workers to work, we need to educate and train the ones we have. And then, of course, we need to go back to the drawing board and rewrite the laws here. You know, and that's going to entail repeal and abrogation of CAPTA and VAWA. Look, the penalties for false accusers, Kevin, and I might add by definition, false means with premeditation and bad faith with malice aforethought. Most of these cases are not that. Most of these cases are made by hysterical moms, well-intentioned moms, protective moms, and when a system gets their mitts in the case, it pours gasoline on the fire. That's what's going on here. So,
right.
If you go back to my website, abuse-excuse.com, and about the middle of the homepage there, you'll see a lot of the statistics over the last 15 or 20 years And the incidence of child sexual abuse has actually decreased by 50%. And the number of reports have stayed pretty steady, about 2.5 to 3 million a year across America. But the number of unfounded cases have actually been steady or actually risen to 65 or 70%. So the number of confirmed cases are like less than 20% or 20 or 25%. It's very low. I mean, it's like one out of four is confirmed. And I'm not saying to bypass the one out of four. That kid needs to be protected. But what are we doing about all the children who are being treated as abuse victims who haven't been abused? What are the iatrogenic effects, the harmful effects on those kids, resulting perhaps from unnecessary deleterious rape exams, therapies, interrogative interviews?
Right, and I remember that from Elusive Innocence. I think you quoted a couple of psychologists. I can't remember the name. Hickman was one, and I forget the other. About the effects of accusation, false accusation on children and families.
I've testified as an expert in the area of de novo sex abuse therapy, Kevin. And I get on the stand and I tell the judge, I said, Your Honor, for this woman, this therapist who has a master's degree, most of them do, to treat this 5-year-old with play therapy, with dolls, puppets, or drawings, or treat this 14-year-old with abuse-focused or trauma-focused CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, before this court has had a merits hearing and made a finding of fact and conclusion of law on the record that abuse has happened and been perpetrated by Mr. Jones or Mr. Smith, that's the same as this kid being treated for cancer with chemotherapy or radiation before a lab or physician has diagnosed that kid with cancer. There is no difference, Judge. The therapist cannot be treating this kid based on an internal CPS finding. CPS is not a fact finder. They are not a trier and finder of fact. They are an investigative agency, just like the police. So, to add to that, no CPS worker, no therapist, no cop, and no Dean Tong can say whether little Susie was credible or whether molestation happened. That is usurping the province of the court or the jury if it's a criminal case. That is Rule 704B. You can't do that. Only the judge or jury can rule on Rule 704B, the ultimate issue. And as far as assessing the credibility of witnesses, that is solely within the province of the court and the jury, period. But you wouldn't believe, in fact, this new case I just got, the therapist said, I believe the child is credible. She can't say that. She did, but she can't say that and get away with it.
But all too often they do.
Well, they do because the lawyers don't know impeachment.
They don't know what
process
to do.
They don't know how to impeach the therapist. They don't know how to impeach the nurse, the CPS worker, the police officer, or the experts on the other side.
There's a, you know, speaking of a case, there was one that I'm familiar with where a little girl was alleged by mom to have accused dad. It wound up in the hands eventually of a social worker / therapist who reported back to the interview place, the child interview place. And that interviewer issued a note that to the police that said that the child would, although she has named some adult, she has named so-and-so and others, that she will undergo therapy intensively in order to see if she will name her attacker, and this could take as much as 6 months. And the social worker set out to conduct an investigation, and it just went right downhill from there. In fact, that was a case where the little girl was interviewed initially, mentioned an adult, a male relative somewhere down the line, cousin something, was put in a year of therapy, and then came back to the same interview place a year later to the very same people, and then said, it was dad. And it went from there. It went south from there. Remarkable power of let me rephrase that, remarkable abuse of power to say we've put these children or this child through a ringer, and we've done it to confirm our suspicions, and we're now going to call that a fact, and then the court is left with such a hodgepodge. It is, I can see how long these go on, because it's so, how do you untangle that nest? It's,
well, the only solution here, Kevin, is a combination of changing of the guard of the laws, repeal of CAPTA, repeal of VAWA on the child abuse domestic violence end. In addition, really, really beefed up, augmented education training for domestic violence advocates and child abuse advocates, everywhere from CPS intake workers to their supervisors to these forensic interviewers that are contracted by CPS at child advocacy centers nationwide. In addition, the legal standard of proof has to be augmented. We have got to eradicate this preponderance of evidence standard, 51%. It's too much in the gray area, the 50-yard line, where a judge can err and do so on the side of caution and not take the risk of putting a possible perp back in the family or around the child or the woman. This preponderance of evidence standard applies to administrative court, where your name might be placed on the Alaska Child Abuse Registry, for example. It applies to family court, juvenile dependency court against CPS and their attorney, as well as restraining order court, if mother was to secure an ex parte protection from abuse order against you. So this preponderance of evidence standard, 51% or 50.5%, which is 51%, it has to be beefed up to clear and convincing. Well, we've got to raise the bar to clear and convincing evidence, 75%. That would be the same as terminating somebody's parental rights in juvenile dependency court. If we do that, we're now requiring big-time proof, big-time evidence to prove your case. Because remember, evidence beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case to convict you so you go to prison is 95%. So that's a hell of a window, 51% to 95%, where you can be, right, you know, eradicated from the family, a no-contact order. And you know, certainly going back to my own case over 25 years ago, I couldn't see either of my children for over a year. To going to prison, being convicted by a jury in criminal court, 95%, 44% window. It'll never pass. You know, and I watched this documentary on TV the other night, sponsored by the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. And it's called the Parental Rights Amendment. You can go to hslda.org and read about it. And it's a heck of a proposition if it gets passed. I just don't think it will, because there are just too many lobbyists, too many lawyers, too many feminists, too many social workers on the side of this huge child abuse industry and establishment to not see through this Parental Rights Amendment, which would afford all parents the right to due process in these cases, where you actually would be presumed innocent, not guilty.
Yeah, and that's always struck me. And other folks have said the same thing, and writings have done the same thing, that an accusation of criminal activity, you know, the accusation of abuse, you're accused of a criminal act and judged instantaneously on a so-called civil standard, which is absurd. That would be like saying, I think he robbed the bank. Okay. Let's keep him away from the bank for a year, and we'll make him go to court and prove he didn't rob the bank. Now, that's an absurd combination of comparisons, but a criminal act should be met with a criminal standard.
I'm going to one-up that, and a family court juvenile dependency act, you know, should be met with a higher standard than what is currently on the law books, which is a preponderance of evidence. This is just too flimsy a finding. Too much subjective discretion and legal latitude for a judge who, for the most part, is an elected official nationwide, for the most part, to err on the side of caution to protect his or her own posterior you know, as well as the alleged victim. And I do stress the word alleged victim because, of course, all police reports already label the woman or child as a victim.
Right, right. And now, what just and this topic has come up. Consequences for what turn out to be proven, or certainly beyond a reasonable doubt, proven false allegations seem to be non-existent. It doesn't seem like anything ever happens. It's a pretty good deal. You can make an accusation, and even if it comes out that the whole thing was just a sad allegation, or you know, I'm going to do this for money or do this.
Yeah, I was successful in my own state about a dozen years ago, working with the Florida legislature and getting Florida. If you want to Google it, it's Florida Statute 39.205, parentheses 6. That false abuse allegation penalty right there will put you in prison for 5 years. It actually is a felony under Florida law, has been so now for about a dozen years, since the late 90s. And I was successful in working with the legislature to get that in. It was tough. That was a tough nut to crack. But that said, I don't know that there's been one case since then that's been successfully prosecuted, because prosecutors will tell you, gee, Mr. Tong, if we do this, I mean, it's gonna put a chilling effect on women and children who would come forward in the future and disclose abuse.
Exactly. And I've heard many people
say, well,
that.
You know, excuse me, Mr. Legislator, but what about the guy who's facing 25 to life, or better yet, life without parole now under Florida law for capital sex battery? It's life without parole, which is, of course, is alleged penetration of some orifice. But, I mean, it's just incredible. So it's still very much a slap on the wrist for false or unfounded accusers. There's no equity there whatsoever.
Yes, I agree. I agree. And I don't see a light at the end of the tunnel for that, given the momentum that VAWA and CAPTA have garnered over the past decades. It seems like it's going to be an extreme.
Yeah, they're always effort. Reauthorized by every administration. Certainly there is a group now, and your audience, your listeners can Google SAVE. SAVE is a organization that's in full swing now to try to repeal VAWA, not CAPTA, but VAWA. And MediaRadar.org is another one that has worked feverishly to repeal and abrogate the domestic violence laws, certainly to raise awareness against actual domestic violence against men, which has pretty much been a closet issue for the last 30 or 40 years as well.
Just for the listeners, SAVE isn't an acronym for what, Dean?
Oh, my goodness.
Is it save.org? Probably.
It might be saveservices.org.
All right.
You could just put in SAVE domestic violence in Google. You'll find it. Ed Bartlett, who is a PhD out of Washington, D.C., runs that group, I believe, as he also runs MediaRadar.org. So he's been a real stalwart in trying to see this thing through legislatively. I, as an expert witness, of course, can testify to certain bills, but I can't get involved. I had to disband my activity with all the fathers' rights, men's rights groups, because it follows me on the witness stand.
Conflict of interest. Is it?
It's the first thing I get in my face from prosecutors and CPS lawyers and attorneys representing opposing counsel, what fathers' organizations do you belong to? Trying to color my perceptions and abate my credibility. So that's been tough to swallow, because I probably get 5 or 10 invites a day from Facebook. But I just can't, because, my role is to try to assist and help and win one case at a time.
Let me ask you this, Walt, because you brushed on it, and it's something I wanted to hit on just briefly and perhaps longer if we have time. Is there, or is there anyone who's recommending, or is there a core of what you describe as better education Is there and or should there be a core curriculum, examination-based, pass it or you're not in, for CPS workers to examine some of these issues and have either a standardized core knowledge with applicability to their area to include some of the legal matters we talked on, you know, the ramifications legally and the, like you say, they're referring to people as child as a victim or a person as a victim. Should there be a core curriculum for people enacted by states to say, okay, you are now qualified to act in this capacity because you know more?
You know, I don't know of any, Kevin, on the bachelor's or master's end here. I know the program I went through for my master's, I hold a master's of science in child forensic studies. It's a very specialized program. I did it as a distance-based learning program from the UK, out of the UK. And if folks click on over my website at abuse-excuse.com, click on where it says, I believe it's Dean Tong dedicated, I'm not sure, but it's my vita. There's a link there for my vita on the left side of the page on one of the icons. And if you click on that and go to my vita page, my CV page, you'll see the actual course curriculum that I went through that's still being offered today at the University of Portsmouth in Leeds in the UK. And Dr. Cece, in 2000, when he recommended I go through this program, he said, Dean, I can only tell you I wish this program was being offered in the United States. It's not, but I highly recommend you go through it. I did. I passed. And, you know, it's not easy. Folks may think that, well, gee, you can cheat online. No, it's not like that. You are mailed through the snail mail the modules. And it's not like the answers are contained within the pages that they're mailing you or on the Internet, for that matter. It's tough stuff, but it takes you everywhere through from developmental milestones of children to taint hearings, hearsay evidence. It's a mixture of law and psychology. It's a great program.
I've been to your website and reviewed that. It's right at the top of your education portion under VITA, first line.
It's a great program. You know, and look, if every child protection worker, intake worker, every forensic interviewer went through this program in the United States, wow, would that make a whole heck of a lot of difference? But
and in the end, it would certainly benefit children, women, men, / victims of any capacity, because it would be a certain level of investigation and winnowing out of a lot of wrongful work, meaning wasted work, I guess is a better word.
90 seconds.
Okay, we're down.
You know, it's just recently, Kevin, probably within the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, where courts are starting to clamp down on child protective services nationwide because they're making such fatal mistakes as leaving abused children to die, leaving already sexually abused children to be re-sexually abused, on the real side of abuse, I might add.
60 seconds.
Finally, judges are saying, you know what, you may be omnipotent, you may have a lot of power, you may have a lot of money, but you don't control my courtroom. And judges need to start doing this and taking control of their own courtroom and not let CPS attorneys and caseworkers bamboozle them and intimidate them, you know, into, you know, they run the show, because they don't run the show. The judge does.
I agree. Dean, you know what I'm going to do? We had a great hour, and we got like 30 seconds. I'm just going to say your address is abuse-excuse.com, and it was great having you on the show. They're going to cut us off in about 15 seconds. I'd love to have you back in the future. And I think this was great. We maybe could pick
10 seconds.
We got 10 seconds.
Love to come back, Kevin.
Dean.
And hopefully with April coming up, National Child Abuse Awareness and Prevention Month, this show will get some hits.
I hope we do. Dean, thank you so much and have a good evening.
You do the same. Thanks.
Okay. All right. We're closing out because we've only got a few seconds left and if I get cut off. But thanks for listening, and you can email us at men.matter.show@gmail.com. And we've got some interesting speakers coming up, and we're trying to work on a group show next month in April for Child Abuse Awareness Month. Any suggestions that you have for topics for people to be on the show, perhaps, certainly email us. Be glad to hear from you. Thanks for tuning in. Always glad that we can have an audience to appreciate and get us for more information. Look to us for more information we can provide and fascinating guests. Thank you again and good night.